Jaya Gopi Ganavallava Girivaradhari Jaya Yashoda Nandana Braja Janarangana Yashoda Nandana Braja Janarangana Yamuna Tira Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Jaya Gopi Janavallava Girivaradhari Jaya Jaya Gopi Janavallava Girivaradhari Jaya Yashoda Nandana Braja Janaranjana Yashoda Nandana Braja Janaranjana Jamuna Tira Gopi Ganavallava Girivaradhari Jaya Yashoda Nandana Braja Janaranjana Yamuna Tira Vannachari
His Divine Grace Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada Ki, ISKCON Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki, Ananti Kodi Vaishnavrinda Ki, Naam Acharya Srila Haridas Thakura Ki, Prem Se Koshi Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nichananda Shri Advaita Gadata Shri Vasudi Gaura Bhaktivedanta Ki, Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gopi Gopinath Shamakun Radhakun Giri Govardhan Ki, Shri Vrindavan Dham Ki, Shri Mayapur Dham Ki, Shri Jagannath Puri Dham Ki, Ganga Maya Ki, Yamuna Maya Ki, Tulsi Deva Ki, Bhakti Deva Ki, Samaveda Bhaktivedanta Ki, Go Premanandi, all glories the assembled devotees. devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to Shri Shri Guru and Shri Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. A reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 7, The Sacrifice Performed by Daksha, Text 35. Siddha Uchu.
Ayam Twakata Mishta Piyusa Najam. Mano varana klesha davagni dagda chi sarto vaga dona samsara davam nanis kramati brahma sapana vana Ayam Twakata Mishta Piyusa Najam Mano Varana Klesha Tavagni Dagda Tri Sato Vagadona Samsara Davam Nanis Kramati Brahma Samam Panava Ayam Twakata Mishta Piyusa Najam Mano Varana Klesha Tavagni Dagda Tri Sato Vagadona Samsara Davam Nanis Kramati Brahma Sama Nanis kramati brahma sapana vana Ayam twakata mishta piyusa najam Mano varana klesha tavagni dagda Tri sato vagato na samsara davam Nanis kramati brahma sapana vana Ayam twakata mishta piyusa najam
Ladies? Siddha, the Siddhas, who too prayed, I am this, Twat Kata, your pastimes, Mishta, pure, Piyusa, of nectar, Najam, in the river, Mana, of the mind, Varana, the elephant, Klesha, sufferings, Dava Agni, by the forest fire, Dagda, burned, Trisa, thirst, Arta, afflicted, Avagda, being immersed, Na Samsara, does not remember, Davam, the forest fire or the miseries, Na Nishkramati, not come out, Brahma, the absolute, Sampanavat, like having merged, Na, our. Translation. The Siddhas prayed, like an elephant that has suffered in a forest fire, but can forget all of its troubles by entering a river, our minds, O Lord, always merge in the nectarian river of your transcendental pastimes, and they desire never to leave such transcendental bliss, which is as good as the pleasure of merging in the absolute. Please repeat. The Siddhas prayed, like an elephant that has suffered in a forest fire, but can forget all its troubles by entering a river. Our minds, O Lord, always merge in the nectarian river of your transcendental pastimes, and they desire never to leave such transcendental bliss, which is as good as the pleasure of merging in the absolute. Purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. This statement is from the Siddhas, the inhabitants of Siddhaloka, where the eight kinds of material perfection are complete. The residents of Siddhaloka have full control in the eight kinds of yogic perfection. But from their statement, it appears that they are pure devotees. They always merge in the nectarian river of hearing the pastimes of the Lord. Hearing of the pastimes of the Lord is called Krishna Katha. Similarly, there is a statement by Prahlad Maharaj that those who are always merged in the ocean of the nectar of describing the Lord's pastimes are liberated and have no fear of the material condition of life. The Siddhas say that the mind of an ordinary person is full of anxieties. The example is given of the elephant who has suffered in a forest fire and who enters into a river for relief. If persons who are suffering in the forest fire of this material existence will only enter into the nectarian river of the description of the pastimes of the Lord, they will forget all the troubles of this miserable material existence. The Siddhas do not care for fruitive activities such as performing sacrifices and achieving the good results. They simply merge in the transcendental discussions of the pastimes of the Lord. That makes them completely happy, without care for pious or impious activities. For those who are always in Krishna consciousness, there is no need to perform any kind of pious or impious sacrifices or activities. Krishna consciousness is itself complete, for it includes all the processes praised in the Vedic scriptures. Translation again, the Siddhas prayed like an elephant that has suffered in a forest fire, but can forget all its troubles by entering a river. Our minds, O Lord, always merge in the nectarian river of your transcendental pastimes, and they desire never to leave such transcendental bliss, which is as good as the pleasure of merging in the absolute. Om Anjanata Murandasya, Gananjana Shalakaya, Chakshu Amritam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha, Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Svaya Rupa Kramayam Vadati Svabhadantikam. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda, Shri Advaita Gadadha Shri Vasari Gaura Bhaktivinoda, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. It's interesting how the English phrase, I think, is all good things come to those who wait. Of course, we could put a little bit of an addition to that in this particular case. But when we kind of calm down and realize our shortcomings and that we're not perfect, and you know, it's not that everybody should be glorifying us and telling us how wonderful we are, we can make incredible progress. Earlier on in this chapter, or maybe the previous chapter, Prabhupada explains in one of the purports that when Lord Brahma and all the devotees go to Lord Shiva to basically appease him. Of course, Lord Shiva is already appeased. They didn't really need to go to appease him. But when they went anyway, and then they were requesting him to sort of continue with the yajna, Prabhupada explains in one of the purports that Lord Shiva explains why he did what he did. And he basically did what he did for the benefit of Daksha and Daksha's followers. And Prabhupada explains that there's two kinds of punishment that can be meted out in the material world, or there's at least two kinds of punishment. One is the, I think we talked about this the last time we were here, but one is the kind of loving punishment. And Prabhupada gives the example of that punishment. He compares that punishment, that loving punishment, as the punishment of a parent. I think he specifically mentions a father, although it may even be more loving when it comes from a mother. But that loving punishment that the parents give to the child in order to correct the child and put them on the right path. I'm being told to raise the microphone. It's a very stubborn microphone. Either it's a very stubborn microphone or I'm not very strong. But the loving kind of chastisement, which is meant to correct and help like that. And then there's the other kind of chastisement that is a kind of gratuitous punishment, a kind of gratuitous punishment or vindictive punishment. And that kind of punishment is good for nobody. It's not good for the receiver of the punishment, because you know they sense that it's not it's not being given in the right mood, and it's also not good for the giver of the punishment, because it's given out of you know anger and aggression and you know even hatred and all of those kind of negative horrible qualities. Actually, I know from, I'm sure we all know, that particularly maybe in the role of a teacher, teachers in school, and also parents, that they're very much advised that if they find themselves in a situation where they have that kind of anger and aggression in their heart, or actually in their bloodstream, I mean, anger is carried through the blood, and that's why it can quickly overtake the whole body, because you've got blood in your whole body, and as soon as you get angry and like that, your whole body can become controlled by anger. But we're advised to actually count to 10 or take a deep breath, step back from the situation, because if we actually give that punishment in that mood, it's really not very conducive. But in this particular pastime, that's not what Lord Shiva was doing. Lord Shiva was very much giving this, or meting out this punishment, for want of a better word, very much in the mood of love, and very much in the mood of wanting to correct the mistake that had been made by Daksha and his followers like that. And then as a result of that, it's amazing what flows from it. It's quite amazing because, you know, in the previous chapters when we're reading them, it's like these two sides are at complete loggerheads with each other. They're absolutely, you know, they're throwing all these curses and counter curses, and they're killing people and chopping people's heads off and ripping people's limbs asunder. They are just absolutely full on into, you know, an extraordinary kind of violent situation. But then, as soon as this happens, and Lord Shiva agrees for the yajna to continue, and all the details of that, and even though Daksha still, you know, he had the head of the goat and all that kind of stuff, then as soon as Daksha comes back to consciousness, and Prabhupada also nicely explains that even though he had a different bodily part, which was a significant different bodily part, the head, which is a, you know, fairly significant different bodily part, he was still Daksha. Prabhupada just throws in the nice, it's amazing how Prabhupada extracts these things from all of these different pastimes. But he just makes the point that this proves that consciousness is different from the brain. Because a lot of scientists would say that's us, the brain is actually us. But Prabhupada's explained, no, now Daksha's got the brain of a goat, but he's still Daksha, there's no difference. Anyways, so when Daksha comes back to consciousness, he then also, you know, sees that the chastisement was done for the right reason. And then he's all, you know, glorifying Lord Shiva. And then what flows from that, I was thinking of Prabhupada's famous quote that we all know, that, you know, your love for me will be shown by how you cooperate together after I've gone. And we all know now the depth of that instruction, how deep that instruction was. So, but this was what happened here. It was cooperation. Suddenly Daksha was cooperating with Lord Shiva, and the two parties were cooperating together. And then all of a sudden, all auspiciousness flowed, and everything became really, really perfect. Lord Narayan or Lord Vishnu then came to the arena. And they all started glorifying it in their different ways. They all started glorifying Lord Vishnu. And the whole situation just became perfect and became completely Krishna conscious, because they had set aside their differences, set aside ego and all that kind of stuff. And just that principle of cooperation, so many wonderful things can come from it. So it's a glorious thing. Also, while reading this, I was struck by, in this chapter, verse 28. And I'm just going to read it. It's connected to the verse that we've just read about material miseries and all of that. But I just want to read it. The members of the assembly address the Lord. O exclusive shelter for all who are situated in troubled life. In this formidable fort of conditional existence, the time element. Like a snake is always looking for an opportunity to strike. This world is full of ditches of so-called distress and happiness, and there are many ferocious animals always ready to attack. The fire of lamentation is always blazing, and the mirage of false happiness is always alluring, but one has no shelter from them. Thus foolish persons live in the cycle of birth and death, always overburdened in discharging their so-called duties, and we do not know when they will accept the shelter of your lotus feet. So what a powerful description of the material world and the miseries that come with it. And also for us, at least for me, a powerful indictment of my resistance to engage in unalloyed devotional service. When this is what you're holding on to, in the material world. This is everybody's looking for happiness, but this verse is describing the reality. And actually, this verse, I can't say for certain, but and I shouldn't speculate from the seat of Srila Vyasadeva, but there's one analogy that's given, that's also given in Vaishnava or certainly Vedic tradition, but it's also entered also into Islamic tradition and even Christian tradition. And it's the example that seems to be almost describing this verse as is. And that's the example of the person who is being chased by a lion. And they're being chased by the lion. So naturally, when you're being chased by a lion, you run away. Of course, you'd need to have a pretty good head start on the lion to actually get away from it. At least I would. And you run. So the person runs away from the danger. And this is it here where it's saying, there are so many ferocious animals always ready to attack. So here, the example is given of the lion or the tiger chasing, and the person is running away from the lion and the tiger. So what shelter can they get from the lion and the tiger? The best thing is to, you know, get up high somewhere where the tiger or the lion can't reach you. So they arrive at a tree, and it's described how they jump into the tree and climb up the tree. Again, just as it's a challenge to be running away from a tiger before it catches you, if you come to a tree, at least again for me, the first branch would have to be quite low in order for me to get climbing. I mean, if it's up there, I think I'll just be food for the lion. But anyway, we get to the tree, and we somehow or other manage to start climbing. And we climb up the tree, and then we get up a certain distance, and then we feel safe, because the lion can't actually get us at that point. Then while in the tree, and the lion, of course, the problem is the lion actually is sitting waiting at the bottom, figuring out that at some point you're going to have to come down. But it's still, there is some immediate relief that you're not immediately going to be eaten by this lion or this tiger. But then the description is given, if I can remember it all, the description is given that then a snake, which is also mentioned in this verse, let me read it again. In this formidable fort of conditional existence, and then of course it's referred to the time element, because the time is the real problem with the material world. Time is ticking on the material existence, and we don't want time to tick, obviously, because we're eternal, and in that sense it doesn't affect us on the eternal platform, but identifying on the material platform it does affect us. Anyway, the formidable fort of conditional existence, the time element, like a snake, is always looking for an opportunity to strike. So then it's described that this snake, and of course a snake doesn't have a problem getting up a tree, it just slithers up the tree. So this snake slithers, and then for whatever reason, it takes position, or it situates itself on the branch below where the person who's ran away from the lion and the tiger is sitting. And this snake has a really big mouth, and it's just lying down, and it's got its big mouth open right underneath the branch where this person's sitting. And then referring to time again, then the person who's sitting on the branch looks to their left or their right, I don't know, looks to their side, and sees that where the branch of the tree is joined to the trunk of the tree, there are two rats, a black rat and a white rat. And of course, the rats are representing time. The black rat is representing the 12 hours of darkness, and the white rat is representing the 12 hours of daylight. And the one of the rats is circumambulating the branch this way, and the other rat is circumambulating the branch that way. And I don't know if you know, but apparently rats, in order for them to live any kind of length of time, to have a long life, they have to continually chew. They have to continually gnaw. Otherwise, apparently, their teeth grow too fast, and then that affects them, and they somehow or other they die. I don't know the exact details, but at least that's what I've been told. Actually, the reason I was told that, I'll just diverse for one second, the reason I was told that was one time, we have some Govinda's restaurants in Dublin, in Ireland, and one time, and we had been open, this restaurant had been open for about, 10 years. And we had never, ever had a mouse or a rat in our restaurant, ever. because we were very suchi. And then one day, the city council, Dublin City Council, decided to put in loading bays right outside our restaurant, which was a good thing actually. We were very happy because it meant that when we were getting deliveries, we'd have a loading bay for them to park into, which was a good thing. But somehow or other, when they were creating the loading bays, they had to do, you know, they had to drill the road and all that kind of stuff. And they disturbed some cavities underneath the road. And the road, of course, is adjacent to the basement. The basement is where our boga room is. And because of their disturbing some cavities and this and that, you know, suddenly a rat got into our basement as a result of them doing their work. And this became like a total panic because, you know, aside from everything else, if the health authorities walk in and they see a rat in your, or they see the traces of a rat in your restaurant, they immediately close you instantly. There's no discussion, they just close you down immediately. So this was a real panic for us, you know, we were trying to catch this rat or deal with this rat in somewhere. So we figured out where they were getting in. So I got a guy to cement it all up, concrete, and cement the hole where they got in. Next night, or the next day, the rat was back in again. They just chewed straight through the cement. It was quick drying cement as well, but they just chewed straight through it. And at that point, we rang one of these companies and they told us that this point about rats, they just have to chew, and they'll chew virtually everything. Except if you mix metal with concrete. So the next thing, we got all these, you know, wire scrubbers and all this kind of stuff and mixed them with the concrete and stuff. Anyway, we stopped the rat. But we would, anyway, this person told us at that time, and he's an expert, that they have to continually chew. So we had these two rats. One is going this way and one is going that way on the branch. And they're gnawing the branch and gnawing it and gnawing it. So this person can see that sooner or later, this branch is going to collapse. I'm going to fall with the branch. And either I'm going to fall into the mouth of this snake, or else, if I escape that, I'll fall down and then I'll be eaten by the lion. So the person is in total anxiety, and this is representing our lifetime, and they're in total anxiety about what's going on. During the time that this is all happening, just above the person, on the branch above the person, bees have created a hive. Like that. And as time is passing, before these rats gnaw the whole branch off, the season has come where honey has been produced. And it's a good season for producing honey. And so much honey is produced that honey starts to drip from the hive above. And it drips on this person's face. And they don't know what it is, but they stick their tongue out and then they taste it. And it's the nicest, most beautiful honey that they've ever tasted. So then they actually actively stick their tongue out looking up. And the honey's dripping down, and they're tasting this honey, and they're in ecstasy, and they're completely forgetting about what's going on beside them and below them. So this verse, it just seems to completely describe that. Like a snake is always looking for an opportunity to strike. The world is full of ditches of so-called happiness and distress, the happiness being the honey dropping. And there are many ferocious animals, the snake, the lion, ready to attack. The fire of lamentation is always blazing, and the mirage of false happiness, again the honey dropping, is always alluring, but one has no shelter from them. Thus foolish persons live in the cycle of birth and death, always overburdened in discharging their so-called duties, and we do not know when they will accept the shelter of your lotus feet. So that's the description of the world we're living in, and the joys that await us if we don't take to Krishna consciousness. But then the verse that we read this morning, today, describes the exact opposite. If I can find it again. Like an elephant that has suffered in the forest fire but can forget all its troubles, by entering a river, our minds, O Lord, always merge in the nectarian river of your transcendental pastimes, and they desire never to leave such transcendental bliss, which is as good as the pleasure of merging in the absolute. So we know from Bhagavad Gita, makchita madgata prana, bhutanyata parasparam, that, you know, the thoughts of Krishna's pure devotees are always absorbed in him. And this is, and why? Because they derive great bliss, transcendental bliss from discussing and from engaging in Krishna katha. So this verse is telling us that. That's the actual relief from the material world. Of course, you know, for us to for us to get to that platform, what to speak as a platform what's that verse? Ramya Kachid. Yes. That, you know, the gopis, the topmost expression of devotional service is the devotional service that is expressed or performed by the gopis. And why? Because they have no care. For themselves, for their family, for their situation, for their social positioning. Absolutely no care for any of that whatsoever. It's exclusively they're just interested in serving the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But first we have to, you know, we can't just jump to that. That realization has to be a genuine realization. If it's not a genuine realization, then we will take it cheaply. We have to understand, Krishna's telling us so many times, Aham Savasya Prabhavo, that he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He's the source of all the demigods, the source of all creation. That's Krishna's position. Of course, just before the Aham Savasya Prabhavo verse, where he's stating very clearly that he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the source of all material and spiritual worlds, the very previous verse is Etam Vabhutam Yogam Cha Mama Yoveti Tatvataha So the Kalpena Yogena Yujate Natra Samshaya. And he's saying, those who understand that I'm the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the creator of all the spiritual and material worlds, if we understand that and accept that and realize that, if that's something that's with us and we have no doubt, actually that's what Krishna says, they will engage in unalloyed devotional service. Of this there is no doubt. So if we accept the position of Krishna, understand who he is, what he is, everything about him, then we engage in unalloyed devotional service. Of that there is no doubt. It's not a matter of discussion or debate or further inquiry. It's a reality. We engage in unalloyed devotional service. And of course the word unalloyed is a really, really powerful English word, unalloyed. It means there's no contamination, it's not mixed with anything, and it's very much a hoitaki apritihata, that it's pure and uninterrupted like that. So that to the degree that we're not doing that is the degree that we don't actually accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And to the degree that we don't accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, to that degree, we have to be extraordinarily careful about assuming that we can just, fully engage in, Krishna Katha and nothing else, as this verse says, that we just merge into the nectarian river of your transcendental pastimes. We have to be extraordinarily careful that we're thinking that that's something we can just do very easily. It's something that takes great practice, great discipline, and ultimately it's coming from the mercy of Krishna. It doesn't come from our endeavor. It ultimately just comes from the mercy of Krishna and his devotees that we're able to do that. But it's very important that we do beg for that and not try to consider, based on our intelligence or anything else, that we can just absorb ourselves like this, because otherwise it does become cheap. And it is a reality. These things do happen. Sometimes, when you read about the mood of the Sahajas, for me at least, it kind of seems almost surreal that I could ever find myself in a situation where I'm doing that, where I'm engaging in Sahaja behavior. It just seems so, how would you do that? But it does actually happen. There's this pastime in Calcutta during Prabhupada's time in the Calcutta temple, where and the devotees, of course, it was quite early. I think it was the early 70s. I'm not sure exactly. And the devotees, there were Western devotees, of course, that were there at the time in the temple, Calcutta temple. They were quite new to Krishna consciousness. They didn't know everything. They were new to Krishna consciousness. So one day, some Sahajas came into the Calcutta temple, and they were in the temple room, and they were performing this pastime of Radha Krishna, and then in the mood of Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda, and Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda were meeting each other for the first time in a long time, and they were sort of taking one step towards each other, then two steps back, and two steps forward, and the whole time there was this incredible dramatic performances, and they were kind of wailing, and all these kind of things. And then eventually, after an extended period of time, they eventually reach each other, and then they embrace, and the wailing gets even louder, and they start rolling on the floor of the temple room, you know. And the devotees are looking at this, and they're thinking, oh, these must be pure devotees or something. Now, fortunately, Prabhupada was there at the time in the temple. So they went upstairs, and they asked to talk to Prabhupada, and they came in. And they explained to Prabhupada that, oh, there's these incredible people downstairs, and you know, they seem to be pure devotees. One is dressed like Lord Chaitanya, one's dressed like Lord Nityananda, and they seem like they're meeting after a very long time, and then they eventually embraced, and now they're rolling on the floor in ecstasy, you know? And they're telling Prabhupada, and they said, you know, I think they did have some doubt, and they asked Prabhupada, is it okay, or what should we do? And Prabhupada said, get a stick and go down and start beating them. And of course the devotees were also apprehensive about that. It was an instruction from their guru, but there was still an element of apprehension. And really, Prabhupada? That ties in actually with the verse, Etam Vabhutam Yogam Cha, that, you know, engage in unalloyed devotional service if you accept Krishna. So Prabhupada is their guru, and he gives an instruction. Are you sure, Prabhupada? And Prabhupada says, yes, yes, go downstairs and beat them with a stick. And beat them with a stick, Prabhupada, that's going to hurt them, or that's kind of pretty heavy. And Prabhupada says, no, if they're in transcendental ecstasy, they won't feel it. So the devotees went down with the stick, and so these two personalities, and I think they had associates as well, who were sort of looking on at this performance. And, you know, they were all still rolling on the floor, and then there were some guests in the temple who were kind of looking at this, you know. So it was a kind of big performance. But then the devotees came down, one of the devotees came down, he had a stick in his hand. And as he walked, even though they were in transcendental ecstasy, one of them was still looking from the corner of their eye. And they saw the devotee approaching with the stick, and they immediately jumped up. So, anyway, they didn't get beaten, but Prabhupada's point was proven. So yeah, so you know, we shouldn't take these things cheaply in any way. At the same time, ultimately Krishna consciousness is nothing but love. It's nothing but loving exchanges between Krishna and his devotees. That is the essence of Krishna consciousness, loving exchanges. We just have to look at the Nectar of Devotion and all the different chapters of the Nectar of Devotion. I think of all the chapters, I think 16 of the chapters have the word love in it. You know, ecstatic loving symptoms, you know, just love, 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 love. So that is the essence of Krishna consciousness, that it is loving exchanges. So it's getting that balance, not that we forget about those things, but also that we don't take them cheaply. It's kind of like just to get that balance right. If you take Krishna's pastimes, yeah, because this verse is also talking about, because it mentions, then Prabhupada says in the purport about the cities appear to be pure devotees, but in the verse it's talking about, or Prabhupada talks in the purport rather, sorry, about in Siddha Loka where the eight kinds of material perfection are complete, so the yogis have all these yogic powers. And one of those, and certainly it's a yogic goal for many yogis to perform, that they can expand themselves. And I think they have this goal, some yogis have this goal of expanding themselves seven times, so as that they can simultaneously every morning take bath in the seven sacred rivers here in India, like that. And of course, you know, on one level, if you can do that, it seems like an incredible achievement. Although all that they do is they expand themselves seven times and they perform the exact same activity in those seven places. So it's like sometimes you go into these electronic shops and they have many televisions on the screen, but the same thing is on every screen, the person reading the news or whatever it may be. So in that same way, these yogis who have achieved this perfection are taking bath in the seven holy rivers, but they're doing the same thing. But then if we look at Krishna, when he, in his Dwarka pastimes, he's marrying 16,108 wives. So it's not just 7, it's 16,108. So that's, you know, that's a big difference. I don't know what 7 into 16,000, well, 10 into 16,000 is 1,600, so it's like about 2,000 times more. So just on numerics, it's significantly greater. But Krishna's not doing the same thing with all of his wives. With all of his wives, he's doing completely different activities all the time. So some, he's taking prasadam with one wife, another one, you know, maybe she's massaging his feet, another one, she's maybe showing him different saris that she's got or whatever it might be, whatever the different pastime may be. And each one of those wives is thinking that this particular relationship and this particular pastime is unique. In other words, you know, I'm the only wife. You know, she's thinking like that. So, you know, just that step up from these yogic perfections compared to what Krishna can do. And these glorious pastimes, you know, these glorious, glorious pastimes of Krishna. But as I say, we have to take them in the right mood and understand them properly. Because as Prabhupada says, spiritual life is like a razor's edge. And if we think about the pastime of Prahlad Maharaj, which is mentioned there, and Hiranyakashipu, when Hiranyakashipu challenged Prahlad, okay, where is your Vishnu? Because you know, he was feeling so powerful at that point that he could deal with anything because he had all these boons from Lord Brahma. But it was like, okay, where is he? Show him to me. Okay, bring him on. That was the kind of mood. So then, as we know, based on the boons, Lord Nrisimhadev appeared from the pillar. Because of the not on land, not on sea, day, night, we know the pastime. And he appeared. So even when Lord Nrisimhadev appeared, and he was massive, we know that picture depicting and this is the deity that we have, Ugra Nrisimha downstairs, right? Ugra Stana Nrisimha, the most ferocious form of Lord Nrisimhadev, when he's literally pouncing. He's on his hunkers, as we call them, and he's just ready to leap and pounce, and you see his nails, and he's massive. In that picture, the BBT picture, of course, in that pastime that I'm looking to see if there's a watch on your arm. There is a watch? Okay, so your brother. In that pastime that your brother talks about, and the what are they called? The carver, the chiselers? Anyway, the person who made the deity of Lord Nrisimhadev. Originally, we wanted Prahlad Maharaj, but initially he refused because he wanted the proportions right. And I think the proportions were 20, was it? 20, Lord Nrisimhadev's 20 times the size of Prahlad Maharaj? Or whatever it was. Anyway, in the end he compromised because it wouldn't be practical for us to have that, to work with those proportions. So in the same way, I don't know if the proportions are correct, but in that BBT picture, you see Lord Nrisimhadev, and he's at least 5 times as big as Hiranyakashipu in that particular thing. Huh? Oh, I thought someone had the figure. Anyway, he's much, much bigger. That's the point. He's much, much bigger. And he's just putting his nails, the teeth, the aggression, you know, just the sheer... You can just imagine the sheer power and force that was facing Hiranyakashipu. But what did Hiranyakashipu... At that very point, what did Hiranyakashipu say? He said, Prayena meyam harinoru mayena. And basically, to translate that into English, in our modern-day English, what that actually meant was, bring it on, come on, I'm going to take you, I'm going to take you out. That's essentially what that verse means. So the incredible demoniac mentality and the puffed up false ego mentality that you're faced with this incredible personality who's just about to rip you to shreds, and you say, come on, you know, bring it on like that. And Prabhupada says the spiritual life is a very fine line. It's a razor's edge. So this mood of this loving, being able to enter into these loving, these very intense kind of, you know, secret in the sense that they're so rare for anybody to have that opportunity. It's such a fine line between being qualified and able to enter into those loving relationships and finding ourselves on this other side, just like Daksha before he, you know, before he kind of repented, if you like. You know, it's a very, very fine line. So in that sense, we have to be very careful. Or at least I have to be very careful. And it is easy. Just one last thing before I finish, quarter to nine, one last thing. When you think of how wonderful Krishna is, and all the things that he does, you know, creating this whole material universe is just a flick of the eye, and the whole universe. You actually have people, this guy, you know, Richard Dawkins, is it? You know, he has a book called The God Delusion, you know. Actually, some of these atheists, though, are interesting. This one called Bertrand Russell, who was one of the biggest atheists of the 19th, 20th centuries, Bertrand Russell. A little bit like Shankaracharya when he was leaving, saying there's nothing but Govinda. Later on in his life, he actually made a statement. Of course, he didn't fully mean it. It was more like he was explaining why people would believe in God. But he actually made a statement saying that if there is no God, then why is life worth living? And this is coming from even great atheists. And I think he gave the example that the atheistic philosophy, materialistic philosophy, is that we are just chemicals. And recently they did in a UK university, they did an analysis of the chemicals that make up the average material body. So whatever they do, you know, those people who give their bodies to science when they die, can't really think of a worse job than these people who do autopsies and pathologists or whatever they're called, you know. Can you actually think of a worse job, you know? It's a quite amazing thing, you know. And you have to get qualified. You have to go to school. You have to go to college, you know. You have to spend years and years and years and years getting qualified so that you can start chopping up bodies. It's an interesting thing. At least they pay well. That's on the positive side. So anyways, these people who give their bodies to science. So some people give their bodies to science. You know, some people say you can use my organs and all that. Other people say, I love scientists. I think you scientists are great. Do whatever you want to do with my body. So anyway, one of those people, one of their bodies, what they did with it was they decided to break it all down and find out how many chemicals and what chemicals make up the average material body. And they concluded that there were 100 and something or whatever it was, I don't know, chemicals that make up your average material body. But the really interesting thing was, which I found very, very amusing, was you can buy those chemicals in a chemical shop, which is normally called a chemist, is it? I don't know. But anyway, I suppose it's more a more specialized type of chemist. But you can go to a chemical shop and you can buy those chemicals in the quantity that you need to make up a material body, and they will cost you £20. That's what they will cost you, £20 sterling, which is about, well, I have to give him some rupees based on the sterling rate, so I better not inflate it too much. It's about 1,500 rupees. So for 1,500 rupees, you can buy all the chemicals that make up a material body. The other interesting thing is that you can go and buy those chemicals and you can bring them out onto a public street or a public park or somewhere public. And you can put them in a bag and you can burn them, or you can drown them, you can submerge them in a bucket of water and hold them. They might try to fight back because they want to live, but they probably won't. But you can submerge them in water until they drown, or you can stamp on them with spiked boots, or you can take out a knife and you can start stabbing them. You can do anything like that, and the only likely thing to happen to you is that you'll get arrested for being mad. That's the only likely negative thing that will happen, but probably everybody will just avoid you. But that's what the scientists tell the human body. That's what it is. It's £20 worth of those chemicals. Yet when it's a human body that's walking and talking, if then if you stab it, or if you try to drown it, or you stamp on it with spiked boots until you kill it, you'll get arrested. And, you know, if you're not very wealthy, they'll give you free legal aid that will probably cost the state maybe, you know, £20,000 or £30,000. They'll go through a lengthy court procedure and they'll do all of that, and then they'll eventually find you guilty and put you in prison for, you know, 20 years, and apparently it costs £200 a day to keep people in prison. Yet if you do it with a bag of chemicals, they'll think you're crazy. Anyway, that was Bertrand Russell. That was his conclusion. Okay, so I'll stop there as it is getting late. I have one question here, that if it's an easy question, I will answer it. If it's difficult, I'll ask back to Rupert Prabhu to answer it. This comes from Chatterdevi, and Chatterdevi is in Chennai, in South East India. which is a lot closer than the last time I gave class here, and somebody asked a question, and they were asking the question from Honolulu in Hawaii. Chatterdevi's question, Hare Krishna Chatterdevi, is please explain the phrase, which is as good as the pleasure of merging in the absolute in the translation. That was exactly the question that I was hoping nobody would ask, because it's certainly my understanding that it's not the same as impersonal merging into the impersonal Brahma Jyoti, and Prabhupada does make reference to it in the purport, if I can find. If I can get the same verse, that is. Yeah, Prabhupada, you know, Chatterdevi, Prabhupada gives a slightly different, in the purport, a slightly different use of words. He says that they always merge into the nectarian river of hearing the pastimes of the Lord. So that's how Prabhupada explains it. It's merging into the hearing of the pastimes of the Lord, as opposed to merging into the impersonal Varan or the impersonal Brahma Jyoti. Anybody like to add to that, or give any addition to that question? Like the Ruparu or Janivasparu? No? Okay. Thank you, Chatterdevi. Anybody else? Any question or comment? Yes, Paru.
Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Thank you for the nice class, Prabhu. You were mentioning that, unalloyed devotional service, and to the extent that we don't accept Krishna as Supreme Personality, our devotion is not unalloyed once we accept. Now, I was thinking that during Prabhupada's time, the devotees who were serving, brahmacharis, they lived so many in a room, they were so austere, and the grihasthas, they lived like brahmacharis and brahmacharinis, more or less, moving from city to city, living separately, and not at all independent in that sense. So, and in spite of that, Prabhupada was pushing this point of boiling the milk, he was saying that we need to boil the milk. So, given our situation today, like me as a grihastha, how much independent spirit is there, and we live differently, we dedicate very little time in service. So individually and institutionally, what should we be doing to really boil the milk in today's scenario? I mean, because we had the same program that Prabhupada had at that time, maybe a little more diluted. I mean, in that sense, we don't do so strongly the programs. So what more could we do, really, in that sense, to boil the milk and come to that platform?
You're suggesting that, from the time that Prabhupada made that statement of boil the milk, that we haven't really changed anything that would boil that milk more intensely. That's what you're saying. Well, I suppose it depends what you mean by boiling the milk, and this is a kind of a discussion topic, actually, in the sense that you gave a nice example there, that during Prabhupada's time, there was this level of surrender, and this level of doing the needful, and this level of being, completely disinterested in any kind of bodily comfort. And even though, I'm not a disciple of Prabhupada, I joined after Prabhupada left, I can remember my first day on Sankirtan, doing book distribution in a van. And we drove out the afternoon, evening before to get to our destination from the temple we were traveling. And it was in the winter time, it was January, it was just after Christmas, it was January. And we drove to a place that none of you will know, I don't think. Maybe Radhika Nagara might know, maybe. A place called Tuam, T-U-A-M, Tuam, in a place called County Galway, in the west of Ireland. And it was a really cold winter. Although when we arrived, it was fine, it was a nice kind of bright sky and all that. But overnight, it had snowed, and it had snowed quite heavily. And the program in them days was, you got up at 2 a.m., you chanted all your rounds before Mangalarti time, then you had Mangalarti, then you had a really sort of decent meal, and then you slept again, and then you got up and went out in Sankirtan. That was basically the program. So at 2 a.m., and I was the new kid on the block, I was the new bhakta, So all the alarms rang. And normally the party leader would take shower first because he wanted to get ready and get his rounds, you know, sort of be ahead of everything, you know. So everything, the alarms rang, everyone woke up kind of, sort of, you know, groggy. And the party leader looked out the window and he saw the snow. It was still snowing and there was at least, you know, 2 or 3 inches covering on the ground. So he basically closed the curtain again and he looked across to me and he says, "Back there, Paul, time to take a shower." So my first experience on Sankirtan was opening the door of a van, you know, with just a gumshoe on, and it's like, it's snowing, I'm in a car park somewhere, you know, that I don't know, and there's 2 or 3 inches or 4 inches of snow, I have to jump out in my bare feet, you know, that my feet are going to stick to the tarmac, you know, thing, and take a cold shower, not even a warm shower, it's a cold shower, you know, I think, and you just do it. You just do it. And you did it, and you survived, you know. So that's a very good point. Now, you could argue, and to some degree, there's different points here, and I don't want to go on too long, but there are different points. One point is, you could argue that is actually too fanatical. How sustainable is that? Is that in the mood of Etanga Bhutan, or isn't that in the mood of false ego? Well, I'm not a wimp. I don't want to show those guys that I'm a wimp. You know, I'm going to do it. So, it depends on the mood of it, that's one thing. And it's coming spontaneously and voluntarily as opposed to being told to do it. So that's one thing. The second thing is, you can argue that that's not so much prevalent now in our movement, not so much prevalent. But of course, everything is about your intention and your motivation. It's not about the externals. The externals can sometimes indicate the internal, but it's not always possible to be able to decide on that platform. And therefore, If you, as I know lots of devotees these days, if they're coming to a festival, they kind of like to have their own space. You know, so from 4 o'clock in the morning to 9 o'clock at night, when they're engaged in the festival and associated with the devotees and doing all these different things, they kind of do like the idea that at 9 o'clock at night they can close the door and they're on their own, they take their rest and they don't get, you know. But does that mean they're less surrendered? It doesn't. It might mean that, but it doesn't. But one way where I'd say that in terms of boiling the milk, and again, this is not an absolute, but certainly as an external indication, I would say that during the times that you describe, study of Shastra, as an example, wasn't something that was done, at least not as systematically and as deeply in that sense as it is done now. So you could argue that all these courses that ISKCON now provides in our different centers around the world, none more so than here in Mayapur, that, you know, that there's an element of where we're putting something in place that would qualify as boiling the milk more, because there's more of a systematic endeavor going into that particular area. But ultimately, whether it's what we did in the 70s or whether what we're doing in the 2010s, neither will work if our intention or our motivation is not right, and both will work if the intention and motivation is right. So that's how I'd answer. Thank you, Guru. Okay, thank you all very much. Srila Prabhupada ki.